Hello, everybody. Welcome to 3-Point Perspective, the podcast about illustration, how to do it, how to make a living at it, how to make an impact in the world with your art. I'm Jake Parker.
I'm Will Terry, and Lee White is not with us today because our third point perspective is Travis Hansen.
Travis Hansen. And this was such a good interview. I got so many little nuggets of like, oh, I got to change this. I got to work on that. I got to do better here. The guy is incredible. Travis Hansen lives in Southern California. You might know him as the creator of The Bean, which is one of the earliest web comics online. He started that in 1999. You can find go to his website, beanleafpress.com, and also check him out on Instagram, Travis J. Hansen on Instagram. And it's H-A-N-S-O-N, not E-N. I put in the wrong Hansen and I got some guy in Florida. So you want the cartoonist in California. What'd you think of the interview, Will? We just got done with it.
It was great. Probably my biggest takeaway, and the takeaway that I'm hoping that you guys listening take away as well, is Travis is one of those people who just decided that he was going to have an art career. Mm-hmm. And he didn't wait to be picked. He mm-hmm. went directly at it and made it happen. Mm-hmm. And it's inspirational because I truly believe that if you are committed, you don't even have to be the most talented. But if you're committed, and I'm not saying anything about his talent level in that comment. Mm-hmm. I'm saying you work into it. And we live in a day and age where you don't have to rely on someone else giving you a job. And it's interesting because I know that we've all been programmed that way, mm-hmm. right? And the biggest question that I get asked as an illustrator is, how do I get work? In other words, mm-hmm. how does someone else mm-hmm. give me a job?
Right.
And my biggest takeaway from Travis is he gave himself a bunch of jobs. He
yeah.
employed himself.
Mm-hmm.
So it's truly self-employed. We say that people that do client work are self-employed. Mm-hmm. And really, they have lots of different employers.
Well, and the irony is the more he worked for himself, the more clients started asking him for work. And are you available? And are you doing stuff? And now that's, you know, he spends... It was just cool to talk him talking about like his daily schedule. He gives yeah. time for service, time for family, and then time for himself, his own projects. And then he has an afternoon of client work to do as well. So I think my big takeaway too from this was the importance of multiple revenue streams as an illustrator. This is a guy who's had a 30-year career so far, or 30 years, I don't know, close to that. He's 51. Yeah. He's been doing it since 1999.
Yeah, 30 years plus.
Yeah. So he's been around the block. He's seen the ebb and flow of industries, and he's stayed afloat the whole time. And it's because he doesn't have one source of revenue coming in. It's spread out on all these things. So cool interview. Let's quit wasting your time and get right down into it. Everybody, here is Travis Hansen. So Travis, thanks for joining us today. This was actually Will who put this together. I think you and Will have more of a history.
We have history. Yeah, we go way back.
Well,
to
tell
the con
me,
days.
Where do you guys?
We were cons.
Con men?
That's right.
Travis, how do you know Will?
I met Will at a show, I think, years ago. We were just talking and just kind of connected. I don't even remember when it was. It's kind of like I've always known Will.
Probably in 2017.
Might have been. Is that when you started doing the cons?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it was 2017 when we met.
And did he come up to you and was like, what is going on here? Or
I don't remember how we connected.
We kept passing you going to the bathroom, and I felt the need to explain why I was going to the bathroom so often.
That's no, probably it.
How could you forget that? So, okay, let's start there. Comic Cons, you are a comic artist, essentially. You do illustration work as well. And that's really what kind of interests me about your work. When I look at your work, I see obvious like newspaper comic style influence, but your subject matter is fantasy and like very rich, fantastic storytelling. That and I would say more of your like panel layouts and stuff feel more like traditional comics. So it's this weird, I wouldn't say weird, it's this kind of like this unique hybrid between what you might see in, you know, I guess there aren't newspaper comics anymore, but what you might see in the Sunday newspaper 20 years ago and what you might see cracking open a comic book today. So comics, I would say, is your thing. How did you get into that? And how do you make it work as a career, essentially? And I have a feeling Comic Cons have play a key role in there, because I've seen you, I think, at every Comic Con I've ever gone to.
Well, I do a lot more than just comics. And the one thing that, if you're going to work for yourself, it's learning how to create multiple streams of income. Mm-hmm. Because the thing about comics is one day that stream dries up and you've got to be able to have something else in the hopper to mm-hmm. keep it going. So I like to look at myself more as an illustrator who plays in all these different genres and has a blast with it. I mean, I'm doing a ton of game art right now. In fact, I'm starting my fifth monster manual for another company. Mm-hmm. And that'll take me, you know, 2 months, 3 months to get done. And then I've got several children books in the work and then a couple other books. I was lucky enough. Yeah, I grew up in reading newspaper comics. I can remember when Calvin Hobbes came out, I was a big fan of Boone County. My brother and I would fight over the newspaper so we could cut them out and put them in our own little folder binders with plastic so that we could protect them. And this is before they were making them as books. And so I've always been a fan of the newspaper, and that's what I always wanted to do. But then in the 90s, I noticed that the newspapers were dying because of the internet. And so I actually got into internet comics in 99, in the very beginning, with Bean. And and that actually, 11 years later, got nominated for an Eisner in webcomics. So I think webcomics is like a doorway.
So I'm just trying to, how old are you?
If
you don't mind, telling.
How old do I
36.
No, actually, I'm 51.
51. Okay. So I'm just trying to place that, because just for context for people.
I was born in 71. So I'm definitely a child of the 80s.
And it's funny you said that about clipping out the comics. I have a stack of Calvin Hobbes comics over there that I trimmed out of the newspaper because I couldn't wait for the books to come out.
Well, I mean, I still have art books that are National Geographics that I, you know, cut the pictures out that I wanted and put in these thick art books. I still have those. I still use them for a reference.
That's amazing.
You know, the cool thing is, I mean, I can remember also, that's when I started playing Dungeons and Dragons. I play, you know, 83, I was playing the red box, colored my own dice. What's funny is I learned at church, because everyone says, oh, that was the era of, ooh, bad, but not really. You know, on the West Coast, we didn't really care. We just, you hid because you didn't want to get labeled as a geek, but that was just about it. And then, but when I hit, when I started doing the web comics, I realized what an untapped avenue to get your name out there, especially when, as an indie creator, I mean, you had great influences. You had Richard and Wendy Penny, who was doing ElfQuest. You had Bone by Jeff Smith. You had Hero Bear and the Kid by Mike Kunkel. You had all these great black and whites coming out. And yet you had to go through, your options were limited for distribution. You had to either get picked up by Dark Horse, or you had to go through one of five distribution options. And it was really non-effective. Whereas when we started doing an internet comic, all of a sudden, you know, you're giving this comic away for free, and my audience jumped all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wasn't just limited to an area where a newspaper would be. It was an international audience. And then by the time I hit, what was it, 2012 is when I started producing The Bean through Kickstarter. Mm-hmm. You know, I had figured out a whole new way to publish and get stuff out and hit that international audience. Now, I don't use Kickstarter much anymore for publishing, because I have found that with international shipping, it kind of kills you. Mm-hmm. They keep raising that. So I found another avenue to make it work. But then when I'm going to do my Kickstarter, I'll do it as a game or something. I'll use it just to have fun. But, you know, after 11 of them, that just wears you out.
Can you clarify a little bit on the international shipping? Are you saying that because Kickstarter takes 10% that...
No. It's because the USPS decided to raise their shipping rates to be astronomical. It's really pushing people, small business, out of the shipping market.
So you're not shipping international on your own either. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, well, we would ship through USPS. You know, so let's say you bought a comic in Australia and now you just paid $20 for that book. Now you got to pay another $20 for me to ship it to you.
Right.
Well, nowadays, nowadays it's $50 to ship. So
I've been through it.
What's the incentive to buy outside of the U.S. when you have to pay triple the price just for that one book of a creator that you like? So when we switched to Kindle Direct Publishing, now you buy it in Australia, you get it for prime shipping.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
And it doesn't cost me a dime. I don't have to worry about it. They handle everything. Gotcha. And we're moving about 100 books a month through them right now. It just keeps growing.
That's can you talk about that a little bit? Do you have to join their program where they price your book?
No.
Control it?
So the way KDP works is you either buy your ISBN number or you can use one of theirs. If you use one of theirs, you're under their control a little bit more. When you use your own ISBN number, that's your control. The ISBN number is the number on the back with the barcode for registration purposes. Now, the way it works is I upload a book, it goes onto the Amazon system. Amazon says, okay, it's going to cost this much for us to produce. So let's say the book is $750. Now, if you price the book at $25, you're going to get approximately $750 back.
Mm-hmm.
Which to me was like, oh, dude, that's a lot better than 10% back from a publisher.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
And the thing about a publisher, and having gone that route as well, you get paid usually a year later if you're lucky. Right. And payment is based on after everything is paid off. And that's kind of where it gets a little fuzzy when they go, oh, yeah, we paid for these advertising costs. And well, I never saw that. You know, I never approved that. But with Amazon, now you can do your own, you do your own pushing and stuff like that, but you get a royalty check each month.
So that payment comes through monthly.
So now I'm making probably 40 to 60% on a book because I priced it where I wanted the MSRP to be.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm in total control over what's happening. I can take it to another printer if I wanted. I can reprint it because I use my own ISBN numbers, but I'm using Amazon's system to manufacture and ship my books, and it doesn't cost me anything.
So they're printing your book too.
Oh yeah, they print my book, and then I can buy the books for shows at the printing cost, which is about $720 a book, because my books are about 100 pages and they're big and stuff like that in full color. But it you can run the whole gamut of pricing. You can really, they have tons of different options. And I found out to be all of a sudden, now here's the kicker. My wife was totally excited because she's no longer shipping books. We don't have stock sitting in the garage.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I just buy what I need. And then at the end, you know, the tax guy doesn't bug me because of it, because I no longer have inventory sitting that counts against me. I think for an independent creator, it's really going to open the doors. I've got several friends on it. Now, to make it work, though, is you can't just do one book. One book, honestly, only has a lifespan of about 3 months, 4 months, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
So the more books you put on there, the better your options are, because someone's now buying four books or five books, or if they find you now and they realize, oh my gosh, he's got seven other books out, I'm going to go back and buy those. That's where it starts to build up and the royalties really become worth it.
When did you switch to that?
March.
Oh, just this year.
Just this year. I released seven books in 4 months.
Oh my gosh.
Wow. So, and these were books that you had already previously published and now you're putting them on
Amazon, were just, these were just the comics from Life of the Party.
Oh, okay.
Now okay. Now Bean got picked up by a publisher. And so we go through a whole nother thing for that. And I'm fine with that. But Life of the Party, I still want to control the IP aggressively. And so, you know, the thing that I didn't like about Kickstarter is I'd launch a Kickstarter, I'd run it, I'd have to wait like 6 or 7 months to finish the fulfillment of it. And I never felt that I could launch another Kickstarter until I got everything taken care of. Now, meanwhile, I've got books that are piling up ready to print. But when you're a one-man show trying to run a full Kickstarter and you're bringing in 70 to 80,000 at that time, and you've got like 1,700 people that you've got to set the backing up and all the little tidbits and extras and stuff like that, you put yourself in a really rough emotional position where it drains you. You're not working on anything else. You're trying to get all the Kickstarter done. And that weight is just like building and building and building on you.
I feel like you are my therapist right now.
I know. I'm sitting here going, because when you, you know, I mean, obviously you know this, but when you have the stragglers that didn't fill out their survey, so you have a backlog of those people trickling in as well, saying, where's my book? But they don't really know how it works. So they didn't.
The stragglers, the updates. I give them opportunities, but after 2 or 3 years, I mean, I can't hold on for you.
Yeah. Right. There needs to be a statute of limitations for
you know, that, I mean, if someone reaches out to me and they send me an email, say, hey, we did this and it's closed now, can we get our stuff? Yeah, I'll hook you up. I don't care. You know, you do your best to be the nice guy. But the cool thing about having KDP now is I don't even have to be the nice guy. KDP handles all that. So if there's an issue, they're the ones that replace the book. And they're very generous. They're like, oh, yeah, we'll take care of you and stuff. So it works out very well for me. That just allows me to create, which is what I want. And then they can focus more on the distribution end, which is something that I don't want to deal with at the moment.
Right.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Right. So these books that KDP is making, what's their quality like? Do you have?
Dang good. Hold on. Let me find it.
I like Jake, your shirt, by the way.
Jake and I are just taking notes. This has turned into more than a podcast. It's like, it's about us doing research right now.
Okay.
It's a little unfocused. There we go.
If you join us on YouTube, go to Society of Visual Storytelling to see what we're looking at right now.
Yeah. He's holding up a book. It's what size would you say? 8.5
by 11? This is actually 8x11. And then when I'm doing the actual full color comics, so these are all the single panels. Mm-hmm. And I got 5 volumes worth of single panels. I think I can get one more out and then that'll be it of the singles. But then when I started doing the serial based, the more of the campaign based comics, I actually built the size a little bigger. So it's kind of like 8x11. So instead of 8x10, so you get an extra inch and it allows me to pull it out just a little bit. So the qualities, I'm happy with the quality. The one thing that I think another artist actually is the one that got me onto this. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I did it, was to test it out. And then I loved it so much. So I'm like, oh dude, I'm jumping all over this. Now I've got 4 other friends that are doing this because they can get their entire backlog back out. Mm-hmm. For people to find them. And it's just opening up a passive stream of income that we don't have to worry about as long as we just post on our social media, hey, we've got something here and we've got another one here and, you know, new book, or just remind you. And it's just simple reminding people that it's there.
Mm-hmm. And
what about the people that hate Amazon though?
Well, so here's what I explain, and I use it this way. You can hate Amazon all you want, you know. But I go, but you want to support indie publishers. You want to support indie creators. You really like to help these artists out. So I go, when I go to a store, let's say I'm in Barnes & Noble, or let's say I go through a big publisher, and I get less than 10%, and I have to wait a year to a year and a half to make any money on that book. And that big publisher is spending more time making money for them off my art than I am. And knock it off. And then, sorry, but they're making all this money on me, and I'm not making a dime for forever. Now with Amazon, now you tell me who's the big bad guy. Amazon says, hey, we'll publish everything. We'll ship it. We'll distribute it. And we'll give you 40 to 60% back on a monthly basis, and you don't have to worry about it. So who's really caring for the little creator? It is not the publisher, and it's not the bookstore. As much as I love bookstores and comic book stores and stuff like that, I know that the artist or the creator or the writer is getting just pennies on the book. Whereas with Amazon, I'm getting dollars on the book.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
It's a compelling argument, that's for sure.
And so I let them figure out it on their own. I go, look, you can research KDP, you can see how it works. But as far as I'm concerned, you know, if you want to support the small creator, find the creator's page on Amazon and support them. Otherwise, right.
I noticed you have a shop, an online shop. Do you still?
Oh yeah, still I still use it? That. Oh yeah, because okay. I do mugs and stuff like that, and I do other things. And I like to control how it comes out. I'm really picky on what my product looks like. So I keep the store just for that. But with the books, it's all new books. I think I'm just going to push through Amazon. I'll keep the prints on the store and some of the other stuff, but it's just another stream of income.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I get that. And that's, I love that you opened with that. Like I'm an illustrator and it's, you have to have all of these sort of table legs underneath your table. So if one gets kicked out, your table doesn't fall over. That's the way I've heard it before. So you don't see yourself ever doing another Kickstarter again?
Oh, no. I see myself doing a Kickstarter, but if I'm going to do a Kickstarter, it's going to be one that I'm going to be totally excited about. You know, when you do 11 Kickstarters all based on books, you're using the system to become a publisher. You're just like, boom, 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 boom. And there's nothing wrong with that. I've got friends that do that and they do very well, but they have a group of people that work with them too. So they've got this whole army of underlings that help them get the fulfillment done and everything else. My underlings, all my kids, they're all grown. So I've lost my, support system here, but, what I want to use Kickstarter though for is more of, I want to do a game for Life of the Party, or I want to do figurines, something where I know I have to go overseas to get the product, something that won't clog the books up because it's separate from the books. It might tie into the theme, into the title and everything else, but it's separate. So then I don't feel the guilt of going, oh, I released two more books now, you know? So that'll allow me to, it's just another avenue for me to play with. I think Kickstarter is fantastic. And when used right, I think it's awesome. Unfortunately, there's a lot of big corporations that use Kickstarter, which is, you know, their prerogative. I can't say no to that or not, but they do at times give Kickstarter a bad name. They start to push out the little creators that are the ones that Kickstarter was originally built for.
So I want to kind of dig into the other side of that coin, and that's the marketing side for what you're doing. You talked about staying active on social media. You have your website that you use as well. What is it? The beanleafpress.com. Do you have another website, or is that
actually I'm on Facebook. I'm on Twitter, which I think is noise. I'm on, I'm on DeviantArt, which I had walked away from for a while. And then I looked back and realized, holy cow, I've got tons of people that are talking on Deviant. I'm on Instagram. I'm on Patreon. I'm on all these different platforms. My philosophy is be on as many platforms as you want. The more platforms you are, the more people find you. Now, it's also how do you use these platforms wisely? And I think there's an issue that creators run into is they bring in their personal feelings into a platform and they start, you know, yelling or complaining or this sucks, or, you know, they'll blacklist another creator or whatever. And that's not what I'm using the platform for. My platform, when I'm on Facebook, I'm using it for like, hey, this is the new piece I'm printing. if I'm going to talk politics, I'm going to talk it in my own social circle. And mm-hmm. I just leave it at that. And my social circle is usually my family, maybe a couple mm-hmm. of people that I hang out with out here. But the rest of the world, shoot, they have no idea where I sit in my social ideas. And that's mm-hmm. because, the one group thinks I'm one way, the one group thinks I'm the other way. And then in reality, I'm just somewhere in the middle. I'm just kind of like, yeah, but I'm using it more for how can I create a little bit of light? How can I create a little bit of happiness? How can I create something that's given away for free and people can come to my place regardless of what background you are, or what your belief system is, and go, I feel comfortable here. So that's the only reason why I use Facebook or social media the way I do, is to just create a safe spot. And because of it, I get tons of work, lots of commissions, lots of art comes through there, lots of new projects. That's how I found almost all of my game art. And I find it to be an incredibly positive avenue if you use it as a positive way. Right. I have found creators, though, destroy themselves and go, oh, I'm done with Facebook, or I'm done with Instagram, or I'm done with this, because they like to bring in all their politics. And sometimes their politics are their own, which is totally okay. But there's probably better avenues that they can get their politics out. Because usually when someone posts a post where it is more of, this is what I believe and you're wrong or whatever, or this sucks, you get about 3 or 4 hits. And that's about it. And it's usually your fan base is the people that are like, oh, yeah, I support you. Yeah, right on, right on. But when I post a piece of art, I can get anywhere from 200 to 700 hits.
Right.
And then
are
I
you
get
taking
shared,
notes, Will?
And then I get
I'm wondering what his politics are. You can air them there.
I'm not going to air them here. But you know, there's a chance to share. And there's mm-hmm. a chance to go, hey, look. At the end of the day, we're all human beings. How do we figure out how to get along?
And you as a creator, you also use your storytelling as a platform to share a message as well.
Yeah, like, it doesn't mean, I mean, that's the good thing about being a comic artist is, you know, who was it? Someone was saying the most dangerous person in the entire world is the cartoonist.
that's a good point, right.
And it's because we see something however we choose to see it, and we draw mm-hmm. that image out, and we didn't write a discourse, or we didn't write mm-hmm. anything else. We just drew one little image, and that image is easier to share than a discourse.
Right, and easier to interpret and understand. Yep.
And there's different levels. So some people only see one level of the cartoon, which is mm-hmm. great. You know, they're like, oh, that's cute. Another person sees a deeper level, and then finally mm-hmm. someone will see the level that I want them to see.
Right.
You know, where's the anger coming from, or where's the emotion coming from? And I think it's important to put your emotion into your art. There's nothing wrong with it. But I think that artists have such a powerful tool of directing people.
Yeah. Opinions. Well, you cut your teeth and were raised on Calvin and Hobbes and Bloom County, right?
I was totally cut my teeth on that. I mean, I can remember the Garfield books when Garfield was fat and ugly before Jim Davis refined him.
Mm-hmm. But like those, I don't know about Garfield, but like Calvin and Hobbes, Bill Watterson definitely had a worldview that he
had an extremely
through that strip.
And, he had an incredible worldview.
Right.
And Berkeley Breath was the exact opposite.
Right.
In fact, to see the comics, they have comics between them that show their opinions of each other. Like mm-hmm. Bill Watterson thought Berkeley Breath was a sellout. And and Bill thought that, or Berkeley thought otherwise of Calvin. So
Right. That's cool. So how do you have time to do all the social media stuff?
So I give myself in the morning, I say, okay, I'm going to dedicate at least 15 minutes to my social media in the morning. Mm-hmm. So I make sure I do my posts. Today, I apologize to all my artists, but I haven't done my posts yet because I was sleeping. But I'll post after the show. But
want to interject there for context. Travis just got back from a 15-hour drive. It should have been a 12-hour drive, but it was a 15-hour drive due to complications.
I feel, 25 again.
It's feeling it today.
But yeah, my social is the first thing. And then I make sure that I'm commenting on it. You know, if someone makes a comment, I play with them. You know, that's kind of why I'm here. I'll play with them. Yes, I get people that want to start something.
Right.
You know, if they're way off base, I will delete the post. I don't care. I just, you know, boom, you know, why is this post even on this comic? You know, so I'll delete it, you know, just because it doesn't belong there. But right. If someone has an opinion, I want to hear it. And I get a lot out of that because I'm like, oh, okay. Because it helps me see things differently as I step back. Now, it doesn't mean I have to agree with the opinion.
Just followed you.
Oh, awesome. It doesn't mean that I might agree with the opinion, but it just gives me a chance to see what someone else has to say. And like when I post if I post a cartoon that might have a political slide to it, mine aren't really political. They're most social commentary of how people treat each other. Because I could care less about politics. I'm more of how do you treat each other as an individual? Mm-hmm. And that to me is far more important because that would solve a lot of problems if people were just a little bit more charitable or considerate to each other.
Considerate, compassionate.
Right. And I think that creates a whole, that would solve so many different problems here. But then, and usually in those, I'll get it, but I'll make sure that when someone's posting their opinion, that I remind whoever posts underneath it that they're allowed to have that opinion. You can't make that person feel bad for posting because I invited them to post. And so they stayed what they want, the person underneath. And I will get into those conversations and I'll tell the one guy that's like, oh, I'm right and this is wrong and, you know, you're going to hell or whatever. And I'll go, look, dude, you're the one giving everything a bad name here. So we will just move you off to the page and then we'll just go on to something else. I want people to feel that their opinion, wherever it's at on the spectrum, matters. And it allows go ahead.
No, finish that thought.
But it allows my fan base to grow because they understand that I am considerate to them. I'm willing to give them a place. And like I said, whether I agree with it or not is unimportant. What's important is that I treat them like a human being and I don't go on the attack. Now, if they attack my family or my faith, then easily I'll defend that without hesitation. But everything else is just kind of like, all right, that's your opinion. Show me the facts. Let me read up on it myself and I'll figure it out. I'll come up with my own opinion.
You started your posting comics online in 1999. Here we are in 2022. You've seen the rise and fall of .coms. You've seen the rise and fall of blogs. You've seen the rise of social media, the fall of some social medias. Now we're in this like landscape where if you don't post a reel or you're not on TikTok, are you getting the kind of engagement that you should get? I'm curious where you get the most traction today.
Well,
and what seems to be, you know, working from this long-term perspective, because I'm sure I sort of see things like, I'm really quick, I sort of see things through, I've been around for a while too, where it's like, yeah, people don't come to blogs, but there's still value in blogging, right?
What I see is it's understanding who your audience is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I if you were born between 71 and 77, you were born in the best era. I have to put it to you, and I'll explain why in a second. The reason being is you played outside. Star Wars came out for the first time in 77, and I was 6 years old when I saw Star Wars in my pajamas in a beat up station wagon at a drive-in. And I can still remember seeing Star Wars at 6. I remember when Superman flew for the first time and watching Christopher Reeve. And we played all of that during the summer, all summer long. We were Batman and Robin. We were Superman. We were Luke. I was always Luke Skywalker because I was blonde. You know, we were, and all, the whole neighborhood played. Then in the mid 80s, video games came out. Now I can remember when my dad got the first Atari and stuff like that. And that was kind of like cool. But by the time the 90s started coming out, RPGs were coming out, the different kind of games that were a lot more in depth. And I'm from the era of we rolled dice. And so we played RPG games. So we understand the digital gaming era because we were teens when that came out, but we also understand the value of play. Two unique concepts. Anybody born after a certain point and all they had were the video games era struggle with play. Anybody that was born in the 60s struggles with the video technology. Game era.
Right.
And so you see this really weird dynamic. So anybody that was in our age group, we got the best of both worlds. Mm-hmm. Now, understanding our audience is the same thing. Is I realize that my audience is people that have been playing games as long as I have, that love RPGs. And so they are established, they have good jobs, and they have money to burn. Mm-hmm. So that's my audience. Now, that audience is not into reels. They'll watch reels, but they're not into making them.
Right.
Now, the younger audience, they find it through conventions, or they might find it through Instagram, and they'll follow me through Instagram, or they might find it. It's like, oh, he plays D&D. Oh, wow. And to them, it's a whole new environment. It's like it was they're the ones that found it. And I'm like, yeah, but I've been playing since 84 and before you were even a thought in your mother's eye. I mean, so there's a whole unique feel. It's just one generation to another. And so we have this younger generation that's videos. I've got to have it now. I've got to see it. And they that's their generation. My generation's a little different. We're like, okay, I can just relax and I can just show a picture and stuff. Now, my generation's going to fade away in 20 years. I already know that. You know, and there's nothing wrong with that. Right. But I hope by then I have brought up their kids, because my generation has grandkids and kids. And who are they buying their books for? They're buying them for those groups who are just starting to play games. You know, the really cool thing about Dungeons and Dragons is it created a whole new renaissance of game players, where they're actually sitting at a table having an adventure together as a group. And my comics, to them, they think it's brand new. But really, the same stories were happening, you know, 30 years ago at my table. And so there's this neat connection that happens. I think where reels become really important for the artist, though, is, and I would like to do this, I have no problem doing this, is the actual drawing. Show me that you draw. There's something mesmerizing watching an illustrator draw or a painter. I find myself when I'm like flipping through Instagram and I go, oh, I'm gonna jump on the rails. I stop at all the painters because I'm watching them. How do you do this? Why do you do that? And I look at what they do and it's gorgeous. And they're doing traditional, where I'm a digital painter. So I use different techniques and I'm going, well, how can I incorporate that technique into my technique? So I think there's a place for them. And I think that is the future to a degree, but I still think that we're going to have all these other platforms where people just like, give me one image, you know, give me, I see cartoon is starting to try and adapt and, you know, really bad illustrations, but they make them move and they do this stuff. And, you know, that doesn't do anything for me. I'm still reading. I find a comic on Instagram that I like and it's just swipe to the next panel, swipe to the next panel. And I enjoy that because I like reading it. So, you know, then I'll buy the book. If they've got a book out, I'll support them and buy the book. So I think reels have their place, just like I think the other aspects of social media have their place. It just depends on what generation is using the platform to keep it going. And as the platforms change, you know, the older generation will slowly move on to something else.
Right. Do you have a newsletter? Do you use that at all?
No, I used to, but okay. I just...
What happened to that?
Well, it's a time issue, you know, like I get back today. I'm kind of off and on, but, I have to teach a class this evening. So I'll be gone at 3:30. I told all my clients,
what do you teach?
RCC. I teach applied digital media and, RC, I really enjoy it. It's another stream. And, for me, like I've got 2 hours or 3 hours that I dedicate to life of the party in the morning. And then the rest I'm drawing for clients. I mean, I've got a big job coming up next week that I'm going to be out of town again, which I'm not thrilled about, but I've got to do it. So having a newsletter and stuff like that, when you're a one man show is really difficult. Where do I find the time? So I would rather just post a comic And the cool thing about Instagram and some of these platforms is if you post your comic first and then your second image is your selling point, you usually don't get hit by the algorithm.
I see. Okay.
So then I'll show my image, and then the back image is, hey, if you want the books, go to Amazon. If you want this, go here. And that keeps it steady.
So have you seen a drop in engagement on Instagram?
So the algorithms nailed me about a year and a half ago. Uh-huh. So I was growing like super quick. And I hit about 15,400. That was my fan base. And then all of a sudden it just came to grind. And I couldn't figure out why. And I just think I got knocked in their algorithm, because I look at some of the other comics that are up there and I'm like, these guys must be paying for something, because this comic does not deserve 10,000 hits. You know, I'm not saying
something's happening.
There's something wrong with it. What's funny is my Facebook fan page for Life of the Party, that's got a fan base of like 34,000. Mm-hmm. And that's hitting like the 700 and 800 to 1,000 hits, you know, likes on those comics. Mm-hmm. So I'm getting more feedback through my fan page than I am through anything else.
But, and did you set up that fan page, or is that?
Uh-huh, I set everything up.
Okay.
I'm my own fan page. Woohoo! Right. But
all right, go ahead.
Hold on. I got a happy dog today. So
that's fine. We all got a happy dog here too every once in a while as well. So
go ahead.
I want to know for our viewers, because a lot of them are younger than us, right? You're 51, I'm 56, Jake is 26, 45.
I'm 45, and I feel like talking to Travis, like I'm talking to my future self. Like, you're saying the things to me that I imagine myself should be, you know, will be saying to me, like, dude, you know, cut out with the Kickstarters. Just go to Amazon. Well,
it's just learning how to, you got to adapt. That's the whole thing about this industry that even young creators do not realize. They jump in, and I was there. I don't know if you were there at one time, Will, but when you jump in and you're like, oh, I want to be an animator for Disney, or I want to do this. And you don't realize that being an animator for Disney means you only have maybe 3 years of solid work, and then you're out on looking again for a new job.
Right. Yeah.
You know?
No, I was teaching my students that at UVU, I'd have animators come back, not broken, but disillusioned with the high costs of living in California, and, you know, getting laid off for the third or fourth time, and finally going, okay, this isn't really working. I didn't make it high enough to be saved, or I don't have a network of people enough, or I'm 2D and everything's going 3D. You know, there's always different reasons, but yeah, adapting is huge. So my question is, if you were trying to launch your career today, what would your advice be to you starting out right now?
It would be the same thing that I'm doing now. You know, the first thing is you have to ask yourself, how bad do you want it? I've been having this conversation with another artist recently, and I said, how bad do you want it? And then he starts to tell me, and I look at him and I go, I don't believe you. I don't believe anything you're going to tell me. If you want to make this as a career, then you will figure out a way to make it happen. You have to show me that you're going to willing to put the effort in. Number two is what are you willing to give up? Now, your family, you can't give up. But you look at how much time you spend playing games or binging a show or watching TV or all of those other things.
Preach.
That's going to, you can still listen to those shows and stuff, but they say it takes 10,000 hours to be a master. Well, that's only 3.5 hours a day for 9 years. Mm-hmm. That's it. That's totally achievable. And when you break it down like that, the kids are like, oh, I could do that. I could dedicate 3 hours a day. Now, I dedicate a little bit more than 3 hours a day to drawing, but you know, that's good. The next thing I would say is learn to create multiple streams, because nothing is secure in this world. I don't care what kind of job. I was an art director for 15 years. Loved it. Thought I was going to stay there forever. I hit a certain point though, I was working basically two jobs because the freelance work was just as much as the art directing work. And my boss knew that. My boss did the best thing that he could ever do for me. He laid me off because he wanted me to succeed. He knew where I was going to be happy. I took him out to dinner and thanked him many months later because it was the neat thing that I needed. It was the jump that I needed to get out here. And because of that, it kind of really put me on my path to where I am today. And that was almost 10 years ago. Now, the last thing I would say is the best advice I was ever given was by Pascal Campion. And Pascal told me, he goes, post something daily. He goes, I don't care what it is. It could be a sketch. It could be a finished drawing. It could be an art piece. And now Pascal posts a fine art piece every single day. It takes him 30 minutes to do those art pieces. That's it. It blows my mind. I know what he's working in too, which even blows my mind anymore. He was building a lot of that in Flash, which is just amazing. But he's right. And the minute that I started posting every day and I would use multiple platforms, that's when my career, that's when people came out of the woodworks going, hey, are you available for a job? Are you available to do this? Mm-hmm. And the reason why I say use multiple platforms and post daily is because you never know what art director is looking for artists and where they look. Mm-hmm. You know, I look at Deviant or I'll look at Instagram. That's how I find my artists. But then I know that there's other people in some of the forums that I'm at that are game designers, and they're looking for artists in the game designers. So having Life of the Party is like perfect because every day they see a comic and they're like, yeah, that's the guy I want. Now, the last thing I will say, and this is the most crucial, is don't focus on fan art for your career. Too many artists focus on fan art and prints. They think that's what the market wants. And what it is it's short-term game, but not sustainability.
Right.
And what happens, you spend your entire career chasing what's the next popular thing. And prints, unfortunately, no one's really buying prints anymore, or I'm not. I'm looking for, if I'm going to put a piece of art on my wall, it's going to be an original. Mm-hmm. Or as I walk up and down the aisles, it's like, all right, I don't need another Stitch, or I don't need a Deadpool, right, or I don't need a Wolverine mashup. What I'm looking for is, show me your art book. Give me a book. I'll buy your art book, hands down. And I'm selling more books now than I have ever sold. I mean, people want books and they want art books and they want stuff like that. So stay away from the fan art. Also get licensed. If you're doing fan art, get licensed, because I know who's licensed and who's not to a degree. And I don't buy unlicensed fan art. I try not to. I want to support the guys that follow the system. But I would say do your own IP. Start now. Create your own IP. Figure out your character and start with that and build your own world and create your own prints. Do your own thing. And it will take longer to get to where you want to go, but it is long-term stability. Mm-hmm. You know, when I started, no one would have cared who Bean was. No one would have cared who Life of the Party was. And, you know, 25 years later, that's all I'm known for, or game art or something like that. Mm-hmm. And they get excited about it. So that was a 25-year journey to get to where I'm at. And the realization is I can't stop. I'm going to keep going and go till I die. Mm-hmm. But I'm in control of everything. I don't ever have to worry about a lawyer getting on my case that I'm using someone else's property unless it's an original. I don't have to deal with any kind of crap. It's just my own thing. I control all my own contracts. And I love having the knowledge that it's mine. At the end of the day, this is mine. Mm-hmm. It's not someone else's idea. It's all mine.
That's the power that artists... Yeah, that's the power that artists have that I think a lot of them don't really understand, is that there are so many people out there that are looking for a product to market that someone else made. But if you're an artist, you're the one that makes the product. Right. That's something that most people can't do. They can't make something that's original. And, right, and we can. And we can.
Oh, yeah.
All it takes is finding a market.
Well, and if you like doing fan art, keep watching what comes out in public domain. You know, there's a lot of new things that came out. Peter Pan just came into public domain. Wizard of Oz has been in public domain for, I don't know, 15, 16 years.
Yeah. Winnie the Pooh just came in.
Yeah, Winnie the Pooh just came back into public domain.
Not Disney's Winnie the Pooh, but the original.
You know, now there's a horror movie about it. I mean,
Blood and Honey. So I want to, you keep talking about your revenue streams. I want to know what all the revenue streams are. Like, where are you getting all this?
Well, they constantly cash change. They constantly change. So you have commissions, you know, and don't, everyone says I'm low on my commission prices, but I'm not. I'm fine for me where I'm at on my commission prices.
How often do you do commissions? Is this like a monthly thing or a?
I get it almost weekly sometimes.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Patreon is a stream of income. Patreon's a solid stream of income if you use it right. Mm-hmm. I get Amazon's now a stream of income. Teaching's a stream of income. Game artwork is a stream of income. Children's books are now a stream of income. Life of the Party's become a stream of income. The Bean is a stream of income.
Do you count the going to shows as a stream of income? Profitable.
Conventions are a stream of income. And there's also, you've got other clients. You know, I work for, I'm a part of a group called Lytro, and they contact artists with different companies, and that's a stream of income. There's small independent creators that are looking for a cover artist or something. Well, that's a stream of income. I'm doing a Monster Manual set for another company, and they want to do two more after that. So there's streams of income there. Mm-hmm. So, and it constantly changes. That's, you know, what people don't realize is a stream of income doesn't always stay the same. What might be really good for a moment, here's a great example, COVID. That knocked out convention stream of income right off the bat. Mm-hmm. And if your total career is focused on convention income, you're not going to survive.
Right. But I personally know some people that didn't.
Yeah, and I found for 2 years, because I had all this other stream of income, I had more work ever than I actually had more work than I needed. I mean, it was great. It was amazing on how busy I was. I mean, for me, my world never changed, except for the fact that there were people in my house.
Right.
You know, I work from home.
You're the same way Lee, Will, and I were talking about how it's like everyone's getting like a vacation, and I'm sitting here like, you know, just grinding. And
I grounded
all this noise behind me now.
Right. And then I've got one more. I do originals every now and then. I'll draw an original and I can sell that original for three times the amount or four times the amount of a regular print.
Yeah.
You know, so it's finding that there are many different ways. Mugs are stream of income or product, you know, and you notice my streams are a lot. But I'm constantly looking for new streams, and I also will evaluate streams. Does this not really do anything that I want it to do? So, all right, I'll push that one away or something. And, you know, here's the other thing that people don't realize. Be generous. Be willing to give back. You know, you get all of this work. That's great. But I bet you'll have opportunities to do something for somebody else that is giving back to your community. So, for instance, I worked on the big band for Kids Need to Read. Mm-hmm. You know, that was one of the charities I like working for. So I find different opportunities to give back. And I find that if you get back, the way the universe works is you get more work, you know, it constantly brings. And that's good. I like that.
That's great.
Also, I would say the last thing on a bit of advice and just that constant reminder is stick to your guns. If you're not going to draw a certain thing or whatever your morals might be, stick to that. And I can remember losing jobs in the very beginning because we had a publisher that wanted me to draw dirty cartoons. And I said no. And it would have been a pretty solid, you know, monthly check. But we turned it down. Now I get a script or something from anybody and I never have to worry because they already know the value system that I created over a 25-year period. So you can control your career if you choose. And that's the key. You have to choose what you're going to control in your career and what you're not.
You mentioned Latro. Latro, is that how it's?
Latro. L-A, yeah, L-A-E. Oh, I forgot how it's spelled. L-E-E-O-T-R-O or something like
that. What is that? How does it work?
It's just a group of artists and creators that kind of get together and they have also people that aren't artists. And they'll find, it's like I kind of say it's almost like an art agency. Mm-hmm. And they connect you with different clients. And you can choose to take the client or not. And mm-hmm. so I enjoy it. They control all the pricing and everything else. And I can pick the job I want. And they take care of me for what I need. And, you know, I mean, it's not steady, constant work. But it's enough that go, hey, we got a big job coming up. You want to do it? All right, sure, I'll take it on. So it's a good avenue. I mean, I guess the key is just, you know, getting out there and showcasing mm-hmm. your work. They found me online. Mm-hmm. They also found me through an invitation by someone else going, hey, you need to check out so-and-so. I mean, we pass people's names all the time in this community. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I don't know how many people I sent over to Will's that wanted like baby stuff for their kid. I mean, we still have the Jack Skellington, you know,
oh, cool.
onesies.
I got on their email lists and I get the emails, but I forgot what it was. Uh-huh. And so I need to like give the, I'm just been so busy doing the podcast and SVS Learn and my own Kickstarter and everything that was like, what, you know, one more thing is just like gonna completely break the camel's back. Well, right.
And that's where balance is needed. You know, right. How do you create balance? And I mean, we all go through it. I almost had a nervous breakdown about 8 years ago. Uh-huh. And it was because my priorities were screwed up. And I had to sit down and write out what my priorities actually were. And then I realized what they were. I had to put God first, and I had to put my wife second. Mm-hmm. And then my kids were third, and then service was fourth. And then my health and work was last. And I realized when my priorities were in that order, everything functioned. I always had work. But the minute I let work creep up and it would take over, everything would fall apart because I would be like, well, I got to get this done. I got to get this done. Or I got to do this. I don't have time to go to this family function, or I don't have time to be here. And now work is totally taking over my life, or I can't serve, or I can't do this. And that's when I realized I had to move work to the very end. And work comes, but people come into my office all the time and they go, hey, can we talk? Yeah. You know, I'll break away for you. I mean, it means I got to work a little later at night, but it's worth it.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jake has seriously misplaced priorities. So you need to take a lesson from this, Jake.
I'm taking serious notes. I got notes on here about everything this guy's saying. Going back to the priorities was kind of like the next thing I was curious about. What's a weekly schedule look like for you?
Well, without conventions, it's functional. No, a week for me is like Monday through Friday. I teach an early morning church class. So I get up and teach that. And then I take my kid to school. And then I draw for me for about 2 hours. I draw Life of the Party. And then I start client work till about 6. I make sure there's a lunch in there. Usually I'll take a quick nap during that time, like a 30-minute nap to keep me going. Then everybody comes home about 5:36. So I'm there for dinner. If I feel the need, I'll start work again at 7, work till about 8:39, and then I go to bed. And then my weekends are almost the same. You know, my Monday morning or my Saturday, it's I'll work for a couple of hours. And after 1 o'clock, it's family time. And then Sundays, I don't work at all. I just take the whole day off.
I need that
rest. I actually do. You know, the older I get, the more I realize how great a nap is.
Right. Oh, yeah. I missed a meeting with Will and Lee the other day because I was asleep. Totally.
It was very atypical. And we're in there and Preston's going, where's Jake? And we're like, I don't know.
I'm usually one like, guys, we got a meeting. And this time I'm like, oh, you guys started. Okay, good. this has been really, really cool. I like that you're, you know, the priorities are right, but then it seems like daily you're not doing client work first. You're doing your own work first. So you're getting like the freshest version of you when you're in that art period, in that morning time, right? Well, is that deliberate?
You have to. So if you want to work on your own projects, you have to create time for you to do that. Mm-hmm. And you have to dedicate yourself to that time. Mm-hmm. You know, for me, I can get four or five comics drawn and then in a 2 hour period, and then I can ink or color them later. And that allows me.
Those 4 to 5 comics, that's a daily post. So
yeah, that will be a daily post. So that's 4 or 5 days worth of comics that are ready to go. So I try to be like a newspaper. I try to be 4 or 5 weeks ahead.
Yeah.
But I find that giving yourself that time is if you want to do anything for you, you know, you need to give yourself the ability to do it. Now, the thing that you have to watch out for, though, is if you allow yourself to get into work time, you know, client time, then you've got to be willing to stay up a little bit later to finish the client work. Mm-hmm. And that's going to be important as well.
Because you got to deliver.
Yeah, you have to deliver. You got to follow through with what you say. And I've got really great clients. They allow me to do what I need to do and get things done when I can get them done because they know I travel quite a bit. Mm-hmm. But you definitely, you know, I make sure that there's my time to do my ideas and my stuff. Now, I always keep a pad of paper next to me I have several sketchbooks and I'll draw in them as I'm working through the day, because I get ideas all during the day. There'll be something mm-hmm. that someone says, or might be a post that someone sends me, or a story that, oh, I like that, you know, and then I'll write that down. Mm-hmm. So I kind of keep that moving. Now, the last 3 weeks, I've been on the road 90% of the time. So it's really wrecked my schedule. So today mm-hmm. I'll rest a little bit more and then I get back into my routine tomorrow. I'll just jump right back in.
Can I ask you, how do you fit cons into this sort of structure that you have going on? How many cons do you do a year?
About between, I used to do like 15 to 16, but now mm-hmm. I'm doing about 9. Okay. And the structure is easy because most shows don't change their dates or they're in the same week period. So I have an idea of what months are going to be con months and what not are not. Mm-hmm. This mm-hmm. year was a little different because everybody was just trying to get back. So they threw a really big show in August that I wasn't expecting, which made me so I couldn't do another show. Mm-hmm. And then another show moved from November and they moved into September, which was the same weekend as Dragon. Mm-hmm. And you know, so this year was just a little problematic, but next year everybody seems to fall back into their normal places. So I can plan jobs around conventions. So it's like, okay. Yeah. And as long as you're upfront with your clients, they know what's going on. I'll say, hey, look, I'm leaving right now for this. I'm going to be gone for 5 days. Now I can do some work, but I can't do a lot of work because I'm working at the show. Mm-hmm. And then you've got other guys like Kunkel too. Mike Kunkel, great example. You know, he's in charge of an animated feature. And so he's got to spend most of his evening, you know, going out and signing stuff off. And that goes back to what are you willing to go up and give up? Mm-hmm. So we both decided, you know, well, I'm giving up dinner, you know, with a mm-hmm. bunch of friends, or I'm going to give up because you're on the floor for 10 hours or 12 hours. Gosh. Yeah. And so, and then everybody's like, well, let's go out to dinner or let's do this. I'm like, no, dude, I'm going back to my hotel and I'm going to sleep. I'm going to draw. I need to. You know, I try to stay with family, so I'm not near the convention hall, so I get a break from that chaos. And so, and I've been doing shows for 20 years.
Oh, my gosh.
So, you know, and I don't have any plans to stop because I enjoy them, but I've got a lot of friends that are now finally getting out because they're just getting tired. You know, they're worn out. And this year wore a lot of us out. I think it really did.
Yeah.
How do you see a con is 5 days, you said.
Depends on the show. Some are 3.
Are you driving to these, or are you flying? Or
if I can drive to them, I'll drive to them. So my longest drive is Seattle. And I know it's going to take 2 days up and 2 days back. But while I'm driving to Seattle, I'm working on book ideas. I dictate the whole time.
Okay. So
I actually turn the radio up. For me, it does. I turn the radio off and I start talking, you know, and I just fill up my phone with ideas in the notes section. Now, I do realize I have to go back and clean that up because dictation sucks. But you know. But I use that time for me, or I'll stop and I'll go check some stuff out. I'll take a slower trip up. I'll use it to visit kids. So like after Salt Lake, Saturday night, I drove up to Idaho. I spent 2 days with my grandkids, which was great. Just coming home yesterday sucked because it was just unexpected. You know, so some shows take 4 hours to get to. You can get to them really easy. Some shows are going to take 2 days to get to. Mm-hmm. I do fly. So like if it's an East Coast show, I got to fly to it. And the thing that sucks about that is I can't bring all my gear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So how do you set up for a East Coast show?
If I've got someone in the neighborhood, I send my stuff to them. I fly out there, rent a car, and then I'll drive up with that stuff. And I'll bring people along, you know. I've got fans that now work for me at different times or different shows. I say, hey, I'll cover your food. I'll get you in. I just need help basically with load in, load out, and making sure I eat during the day and help me stay functional. So, you know, you get to kind of get a vibe on people, and you just kind of like invite them to the party.
Do you find with cons, it sounds like you're prolific enough that every time you go to a show, there's something new on the table. Right.
Yeah. There has to be.
Is that the key essentially to having a successful con?
Well, so a successful con varies on several factors. Okay. The first factor is how long have you been doing the show and how well are you known? Mm-hmm. So if you do a show for the first time and nobody knows you in the area, you might make a decent amount of sales. You'll probably break even. You'll do good. But if you've done that show for 6 years, now everybody knows where you're at, or they know that you're going to be there. So you're definitely going to make well, as long as you have new product on your table. Mm-hmm. And that's the key is how do I get new product? Now, prints are tough because people are running out of wall space. They're like, well, I can't put the print up. I don't want to buy any more prints. Mm-hmm. But books are different, or games, because it's a tangible item that they can put in a bookshelf, or they can put on a coffee table, or they've got a game because their kids or their grandkids are growing up and now they can play. And so that's a whole different avenue. So, which is one of the reasons why we went to KDP, was now I had 10 new books, 7 through KDP and 3 through other publishers that were on my table this year. And that's we would come home empty. So my goal next year is to have at least 4 or 5 new books starting in March.
Right. Wow.
And by keeping that rhythm, people will come back. Well, what don't I have? Or I bought the first 2 books. Now I can buy the next 2 books. Oh, you got new books out. Okay. We'll get those next time. So you've got to have new stuff on your table. This is where I go, you know, IPs are, make sure they're your IPs. If you want longer stability, make sure it's your IP. Work on that. Work on merchandising. You know, add mugs, add shirts or something. How do I get creative at my table? If you focus solely on someone else's IP, sooner or later that dries up. Right. And you just have to move on.
Right.
The other thing is make it look nice. Get out of Artist Alley. The minute I left Artist Alley, my sales increased 60%. Because I was no longer competing against with 2 artists on the side of me and the 3 artists in front of me. Right. Because what happens is people walk by, they'll buy from the guy next to you, but because they just bought from the guy next to you, they don't want to buy from you. So they'll skip you and they'll keep moving down.
Right.
But when you get a corner or you get an inline or something and you're on the main floor as an exhibitor, your competition is toys and your competition is, you know,
back clothing issues
and stuff like that. So you stand out as an artist and people go, oh, who are you? You know? And so that opens up a lot of real estate. The other thing is corners are the best because you get the most real estate out of a corner.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. You know, and you got to look at what you're putting on your table. Some people, you know, they throw whatever is on their table. I got stickers, but if stickers are covering, you know, 20% of your table, that's not effective placement on your other merchandise that might have a bigger price point. So you want your bigger price point out so more people can see it than your
smaller. My thing is, don't do stickers. They don't pay for themselves. Some people will definitely take issue with that, but like, I mean, you make a print, it costs you $1, you sell it for $20 or $30. You cannot compete with that with the sticker. The sticker's going to cost you a dollar or two, and you can sell it for $5.
Well, then you run into the issue that people are like, oh, I don't have to spend $30 on you. Now I can just spend $5.
Right. Mm. That's the other thing. You cannibalize your sales with your own product. Mm-hmm. You're competing with yourself. Yep.
I try to keep my price point between 15 and 30. Yeah. So that allows it to just, you know, everything.
Your sticker's better off as hey, buy a print, you get a free sticker.
Well, yeah. and then you find out, people find trends. So I can remember when buttons were a trend. And then these guys would show up at a convention and they would have like 6 presses and they're cutting comics and making buttons and they're selling them for cheap. And they just totally flooded the button market, just totally destroyed it. Yeah. Then you've got stickers did the same thing. They came out, everybody was doing stickers. People are still doing stickers. Right now, enamel pins are the hot item.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's like everyone's trying to jump on what's the next popular thing. What's funny is I always go back to books because books always sell, regardless of where I'm at.
Always. And it's hard to make a book, so you have less competition, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Well, it's, I'm not going to say it's harder to make a book. They just don't know where to look. They don't know what resources are available to them.
I don't mean it's hard to get a book printed. It's hard to
like, that's what I'm saying. Because their mindset's different. Their mindset is like, I got to make a buck. I got to pay my table. I got to get this. So I'm going to try to get whatever I can out at the moment. Well, that's not the right way to look at it. You need to really kind of go, what's my long-term goal?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I was talking to this other artist, this young guy, and he said that his long-term goal was to create a book that would be totally different than anything else anybody has seen. You know, it was going to change the world of comics. And I said, that's not a long-term goal. And I go, what happens when you're done with that book? And he's like, I don't know. I go, you created nothing for you to keep moving on. And once you realize that that book doesn't move, then you're going to get depressed and frustrated and leave the business. I said, you got to look beyond that. That's why I look at myself as an illustrator, because I'm going to create multiple stories. I'm going to create multiple books. I'm going to just do what I want to do. So I'm never locked into one book. I'm always working on the new project. I've always got something else coming down the pipeline.
Yeah.
The other thing is when you're writing a book or you're creating your own IP, I listen to people and they go, yeah, I'm going to write an IP that changes the world, or I'm going to do something that's eco-friendly, or I'm going to do, you know, we're going to do this cause here or whatever. Well, that's great. The issue is, though, is if you're writing for a cause or to change something or whatever, those books don't sell. They just don't. They have a niche audience, and that's about it. You can't get them it's really hard to get them out into the world. I tell people, look at that 13 to 15 year old self that you used to be, and you write the book that 13 or 15 year old was going to read.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And those are the best stories.
Yeah. You know? And you could put your,
you put your message
you believe in. You put your message in there. Sneak it in.
Well, you're not even just sneaking it in. It just goes in naturally.
Right.
But write the book that you would have read as a 13 or 15 year old. Right. Create the art that you would put up in your room. And not the art that you think somebody wants to put up in their room, because more than likely they don't. And if you do that, your audience will find you. They come. They you will find that there's an audience out there for anything that you do.
Yeah, that's awesome. So you working at this for 20 plus years, when you launch a book, how many books can you expect to sell?
I have no idea. Well, no, because it changes all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, you never know. So when I launched the first book of Life of the Party, we had really incredible high sales. Boom, it just went really good. When I launched the seventh one, because I had done it in such a short time, I flooded my own market. Mm-hmm. I knew what I was doing because I wanted all 7 books for the shows, but I hurt my online sales because of it.
Mm-hmm.
I should have spread it out like every 3 months, launch a new book. But I get my issue is I get angsty and I'm like, I got to get this out now. It's like, I can't, I don't want to wait. I just want to get it out and just see what happens.
Yeah.
I don't worry about how well a launch does or anything else. That's not, I mean, it's important, but it's not important. I worry about it's out. Now I can start getting it to show so people can see it and go from there.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I'm going to start a whole new line of children's books, and I'm curious to see how that's going to go.
And these are self-published sort of thing. Okay.
Yeah, I'd rather self-publish than go through a major publisher.
It's interesting how self-publishing used to have a stigma attached, and now it's quickly going away. It does in some circles, but there's a lot of smart creators that are making a really good living.
Oh yeah, you can do very, very well in self-publishing if you want to.
Yeah.
The books that you said The Bean is being published by a publisher?
Yeah.
Well, who's
Outland is publishing Bean. But I've known Jeremy over at Outland, who owns it, for 20 some years, and we set up a very good contract for it to be done, and he really wanted to do it, which helped me because I was kind of tired of it.
Yeah. So if not for that, you wouldn't have gone with
right. But now that they're involved and they're making things work and stuff like that, it's kind of inspired me to get back into it. Mm-hmm. So that's sometimes cool. Having someone, a publisher, helps you stay focused.
Can I ask, of these revenue streams, book publishing, freelance work, commissions, cons, all that stuff, there's sort of like this long tail, like you get a certain amount from a certain revenue stream. Where you're at right now in 2022, what's like the top revenue stream and what's like the bottom? Diminishing returns.
I have no idea. I kind of figure that out when I get ready to do my taxes.
Tax time. You're like, whoa, we did way better in this than I thought.
Can we see your taxes?
No, you cannot. No, okay. The issue that I think that you run into, like conventions, you can go, oh, well, that's a great revenue stream, but people don't realize how much money goes into conventions as well. There's a lot of money that we pay to do that.
Publishing. And you have money sitting out there for a year. A lot of people don't realize that you have to renew your next show at the show to get the discount. So you've got money sitting in every city that you go and do a show at.
Exactly. And then
you're going to wait a year to use that money. And then you've got to pay again. So the only way to really cash out of the shows is to stop doing it.
Yeah. And I choose not to, you know. I mean, I do well enough now that I cover all my costs. And the goal is, if you're doing conventions, you just cover your costs so you can do it again. You know, if that's what you like, you know, keep covering your costs. When you're dealing with publishing, you got to remember there's a publishing cost. You know, even though I use KDP, if I still want books on my table, I got to buy the books. So I'm going to spend money there.
Yeah.
You know, there's constant areas where you spend money. Mugs, I got to buy product. But mugs, you know, I look at it as long as the return is at least 1.5. In my favor, and then I will do the product. So like a mug or something, I'll get, you know, I got my cost, but I've got to make at least 1.5 more over that mug to make it worthwhile. Same with a book. I got to make at least 1.5. And it's not like I'm trying to be greedy and stuff. It's just, that's how I have to do it to survive.
Right. And business.
And that's what it is. Unfortunately, you know, you have to think about what business is. You know, this is a job. It's a career. This is not a hobby. And a lot of people treat, oh, this is my hobby. This is my secondary. And because they treat it that way, they never go anywhere. But the minute you're willing to treat it like an actual business, then it becomes a very realistic that has expenses, that has returns, that has, you know, all these different features to it.
Cool. Well, I mean, I feel like I could ask 100 more questions, but
I'll come back on.
I think I just want to have you as a consultant.
You're a pro, Travis. I knew this was going to be a good interview.
You've
done it long enough. And well, I'll save some of these comments for after you leave because we want to talk about you.
Is there anything closing you wanted to say before we let you go? It's been a steady drip of wisdom this whole time.
I would say is, you know, if you've got a story idea or a dream or whatever, the only person that stops you from doing it is you. You're the one that stops you. No one else does. No one else ruins your life. You're the one that makes the decisions and the choices that get you to where you need to be. And you, you know, and in this industry, once you start to realize that I can do it, you just got to keep at it, keep walking forward, and realize that every other artist is doing the exact same thing. They just are at a different point on the road. Don't compare yourself to them. Just be you. And you'll find that audience. You'll find that group that'll support you. But at the same time, be humble about it. You know, I'm very grateful for those that are there for me. I'm very grateful for my fan base. I treat them like people. I don't treat them like fans. And I think that is a major difference. We're in an industry that people have unprecedented access to creators. Mm-hmm. You know, 10 years ago, you could hide behind a table and no one would know who you are. Now, everybody can say something to you, reach out to you, whatever it might be. It's nothing like it was. And so just be mindful of that. One thing that you do or action or thing that you say can destroy your entire career in a moment. You'll have to rebuild it from scratch. Mm-hmm. So you just have to work smartly.
All right. We just finished with Travis. That was really cool. I felt like I said it in the interview, but I felt like I was talking to a version of myself who'd been, you know, who's like wanting to like wake me up and tell me this is how you got to do things. This is where you need to like tighten up. So I really appreciate that. He's a cool guy.
Yeah, he really is. And he's worked so hard and he continues to work hard. His work ethic is crazy.
Right.
At 51.
Right. Yeah. He didn't move into a retirement community is what he didn't do.
That's right.
No,
I feel like that was a jab.
Listen, you're living your best life, Will Terry. You're living your best life. You have so much balance, which is making me jealous some days. That's for sure. No, but again, I just want to remind people they can go to beanleafpress.com to see his website, learn more about him. Go to Travis J. Hansen on Instagram, follow him there. He's on Facebook, as he said. He's on Twitter. You just Google him and you'll figure out where you can see him. I also would just want to close too and remind people that we do have a Patreon now for the podcast. We've got a bunch of people signed up there. They're getting our Q&A live streams that are a fun time for everybody. They're getting episodes that we don't release publicly, sort of private premium episodes. They're getting pro tips that we're sharing with people, kind of like how we work in our studio. So if you want a little bit more, you want to support SVS, you want a little bit more insight into the world of illustration, you must go to patreon.com/3Point Perspective and sign up there. All right, thanks for joining us. 3 Point Perspective is made possible by our Patreon and also svslearn.com, where becoming a great illustrator starts. Your hosts are Will Terry, Lee White, and Jake Parker. Will Terry can be found at willterry.com, Lee White at leewhiteillustration.com, and I can be found at mrjakeparker.com. Podcast produced by Daniel Tu. That's danieltu.co. Special thanks to Keeper of the Curriculum, Austin Shirtliff, Show Notes Wrangler, Lily Howell, Chief Operations Officer, Lucy Fott, and lastly, you. Now, go draw something.